First case in our calendar is 94-1675, State of Ohio Art Trail Jeffrey Newman versus the Industrial Commission. Ms. Nestor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court, counsel. My name is Cheryl Nestor. This is Attorney General representing the Industrial Commission of Ohio this morning. In this case, we are concerned with three claimants for workers' compensation, each of whom suffered an injury in the course of arising out of their employment from the fall of 1988. Each of the claimants had worked for a temporary agency and had been injured while on the premises of a customer of that temporary agency. Each of the claimants then filed a claim for workers' compensation. Each application named only the temporary agency as the employer. Each claim was processed and allowed, with the employer being a temporary agency. Workers' compensation benefits were paid as appropriate in each case. And it was not until sometime later that each claimant then also filed an application for an additional award for a violation of specific safety requirement by the employer. Only this time, each claimant named as an employer not only the temporary agency, but also the customer of that temporary agency.
If we were to adopt the commission's view in these cases, would the result be that someone such as the claimants here could never file a VSSR claim?
At all? I would.
They could file it, but I mean, would there be anyone against whom they could recover or receive the penalty?
I think the major concern in this case is that the claim began and the employer was determined to be the temporary agency. The customer was never named initially and never found to be an employer. So the customer, whether an employer or not, has never been apprised of the initial claim, has never had the opportunity to come in and defend against the workers' compensation claim initially, but yet is being brought in now at this late date.
But the claim
application for VSSR, when they're being penalized, they cannot now go back and challenge the initial allowance, the existence of the claim at all.
But the claimant's argument is that they contracted that right away. Presumably they paid a premium for the temporary service help by giving up the responsibilities for paying workers' comp and filing all the forms and making all the terminations. They contracted that right away to the agency itself. And so in that sense, haven't they already made their statement and made their payment in an indirect fashion for the worker compensation?
I think that's presuming quite a bit. They certainly contracted away having to do the paperwork, having to pay the premium. There's also the question of whether they, I suppose you could go back and challenge the initial holding of the end of the case to whether these customers are even employed. The concern primarily here is notice of due process. And if you have no opportunity, while you're certainly, as a customer, you're certainly asking that temporary agency to provide you with workers, you are certainly asking them to take care of all the unemployment comp, the workers' comp, the payroll. I don't know that you're
extracting
away your ability to test the claimant specifically against you.
Well, they're basically saying, we don't want to fool with workers' comp. That's why we're using an agency like this. They can worry about the workers' comp. But then they want all the benefits. It seems like they want their cake and want to eat it, too.
Well, if this court is going to hold that they can, and if they apparently are holding, they can't employ the workers' comp purposes, then are they not entitled to initial notice of the initial claim and the ability to defend against that claim, especially if they're going to be subjected to a specific penalty? Not merely.
But don't they have the right to? Don't they have the right to contest the VSSR itself?
Well, presuming that they come in at the point, they could contest whether or not they violated a specific safety requirement. What they will lack is the ability to contest whether an injury even occurred.
They contracted that ability away to the agency.
I think that's somewhat of a belief. I don't think any reasonable person would contract away something that
that the only problem you see in this case is the lack of notice of the initial stages of this claim that had a judgment, that it would be okay, that'd be no problem.
I think that's the most important problem. I don't know that it's the only problem.
But that seems what Lake and Grant emphasized, that issue twice now, the lack of notice. So I assume that's the most important thing in your mind. That
I think that is the holding of the Industrial Commission. This is the case in Mandamus, so we're looking at whether the Industrial Commission properly held this. In each of these cases, the Industrial Commission, when they looked at the application for BNSR, basically held that the temporary agency had already been established as the employer in that claim, and that they had no jurisdiction to now go back to the third party who had not been a part of the claim to that point and hold them as employers.
In the workers' compensation context, can there simultaneously be dual employers?
There is no specific provision. While there could, I suppose, potentially be some concept of that, what we're most concerned with here is what the Court of Appeals has done.
Yeah, I understand we're concerned about. My question was, can there be ever dual employers in the workers' compensation context, or am I not working for either general contractor or subcontractor?
You end up with that, to a certain extent, in the case of occupational disease, where you're finding a number of employers who could have been responsible. There is no instance that I'm aware of in which two employers have been found.
Then if you have a situation like here, should one then be primary and the other excess? Or secondary?
I would think that in this instance, if you do have temporary customers, it is, I admit, an unusual situation. My concern is that you have two tracks for regular workers' compensation and the PSSR track.
But isn't it fair to say, under your solution to this problem, that there would be nobody responsible for the violation of the safety requirement?
In this particular instance?
In all of these cases, because this is the only one we have. We have, I think, what, three consolidated here? And I looked at something early this morning. I think there are another maybe five pending. And under those circumstances, it seems to me what you're arguing is the temporary agency can never be responsible for a specific safety violation. The employer who hired the temporary agency to get them an employee are not responsible because they're not the employer of the employee. So don't you specifically build into the law that way the ability to violate specific safety requirements, ergo violate statutes without liability?
I don't believe that. There's two ways that the customer could be held responsible for that. One way, potentially, could be to name them initially as the employer and have them established as the employer initially. The other way would be for this court to determine that the Daniels case doesn't cover the situation that we're talking about here. The Court of Appeals relied heavily on Daniels and found it to be controlling, even though the Daniels case does not address the issue of the BSSR. The Daniels case only goes to whether, in a workers' compensation system, a claimant can sue in negligence the customer of a temporary agency.
So if we charge this against the employer's, the customer's experience, you're not going to come back in here and say, like the customer will, it's not our employee. You're going to say, sure, it wasn't their employee, it was somebody else's employee. Now, it may not be you, but somebody from the Attorney General's office very well be down here, and I'll remind them of you being here, and they'll say, well, that's a different case.
The workers' compensation benefits are charged against the risk of temporary agency. If we're talking about BSSR, that's a specific penalty.
We're talking about BSSR.
Directly by the entity employer responsible and is not part of the premium.
So are you saying that you see no problem in holding that way, to hold an employer responsible? Not the employer, but to hold this
the customer
responsible in the VSSR situation.
In civil ways, you're talking about a situation where workers' compensation benefits have been paid, you sue just in negligence or compensatory damages, you get a double benefit to the claimant there. I would see that as unfair, and I understand the Daniels case in that light. If you're talking about a VSSR for punitive damages, that's not under the workers' compensation system. And I would see that as a different entity entirely.
Isn't that that very aspect of this situation argued in favor of the appellee here, in that the right to participate and regular compensation that comes as a result of an injury is entirely separable from the VSSR penalty? You're joining them in terms of notice, but aren't those two really entirely distinct?
Not entirely, because if you were suing this customer civilly, he would have the opportunity to challenge the entire claim. In this instance, if you bring in the customer only at the point of the SSR, a great deal of information is already established without the ability of the customer to...
But to establish a VSSR, one has to... I assume the proof in the VSSR is, and I don't remember this, but requires that you, A, establish a causal relationship between the equipment, or the lack thereof, and a sustained injury.
Exactly. You have to assume that you have to prove that there was a violation of the sustained requirement and that it was the cause of an injury. In a workers' compensation claim, the injury is already established before you get to the SSR.
Right. But I don't know if there's going to be much of a problem. I'm not sure I see that. The injury, the proof of an injury in these kinds of situations would not be such a hurdle.
Whether it's much of a hurdle or not, it still should be the opportunity of the person against whom a penalty is being assessed. This isn't simply benefits. This is a specific penalty being assessed, and they ought to have the opportunity to put on whatever defenses they have available to them under the principles that you process.
But this person's, I mean, really, you're talking about this equipment. This person has what? A broken leg. You know, they're quadriplegic from a fall, and it's the scaffolding or not. It's really the issue in the VSSR. You're saying that the VSSR customer who's in charge of that would be unfairly, wouldn't have to process by not being able to show that the person did not have a broken leg?
Well, the mere fact of injury is enough that a worker's compensation, it has to be an injury sustained in the course of an employment, and that would be part of what a customer could also challenge, whether it came in the course of arriving out of the employment. So there are a number of issues that I think you can't.
The equipment would have to be part of the employment, though, wouldn't it? In the VSSR, whatever the object,
whatever the alleged object.
So that it has to be in there. I think maybe regardless in the VSSR, because that equipment has to be used in the course of employment, whatever your focus is.
That's certainly true.
Let me pursue your suggestion that that a way to fix this would be to, maybe I'm overstating it, but if notice were given to the customer here as well as the temporary agency, that then the customer is in the original hearing. But doesn't that seems easy? But doesn't that raises all the issues about who is the employer? Doesn't it? I mean, you have all this law that we'd have to, I suppose, discard, or what would we do with it? Obviously, here the temporary agency was determined to be the employer because of the application, I assume, of the test to decide who, by whom this person was employed. How does that get us any place with respect to the issue of whether there can be two employers for this purpose?
I think that determination has to be made on a case-by-case basis. Our concern here isn't whether or not there can be two. Our concern is we've created two tracks here, one for workers' compensation benefits, one for VSSR. There's no provision for that in statute. We would suggest that this is basically a judicial legislation. It should not have been.
I guess that's what I'm wondering. There seems to be a void, at least a situation which the General Assembly is apparently silent. Should we leave it to them to fix it, or is the gap so small that we can fix it.
I was just presenting that for the legislature. It has far-reaching consequences, as at least our dear temporary agencies are becoming more and more a way of life for workers in America. And the fact that the legislature has overlooked this matter to this point is something that can be remedied. There's certainly, Mr. Jackie's presence here this morning indicates there's certainly an interest in a lobbying group that can take care of that.
Thank you, Ms. Nestor. Mr. Kaufman.
Good morning, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, my name is Walter Kaufman. I represent the plaintiffs and athletes, Jeffrey Newman, Kelly Henderson, and Hilliard Foster. I think the issue in this court today, and the only issue in this court today, is whether any temporary employee in this state out of the practice that's been initiated and continued by the Industrial Commission has any coverage from the safety regulations or safety requirements published by the Industrial Commission pursuant to Article 2, Section 35 of the Ohio Constitution. And let me say that the Industrial Commission itself has stated that the purpose of the safety requirements is to provide reasonable safety for the life, limb, health, and health of employees. What it has determined in this particular case is that a temporary employee gets no such protection whatsoever because it refuses to do anything.
Well, let's be fair with about the commission. Is there in statute, is there in the statutes any place that the authority to do what it is you want to have us or have done for your claimants? There seems to be a void here, isn't there, or at least an absence of...
No, I think that if you look at the both the constitutional scheme, and you have to look back to Article 2, Section 35 of the Constitution, and all of the cases that have decided the scope of VSSRs and this employer question are all consistent. The only thing that is inconsistent is the Industrial Commission's irrational position that a temporary employee gets no protection, for the simple reason that they were not named as the employer on the underlying application. And let me say that, really, you have to go back to what is Article 2, Section 35 and the 1923-24 amendment to Article 2, Section 35 all about. There were really two public policies that were furthered by Article 2, Section 35 and the 24 amendment. The first public policy was to create a system for the health, safety, and safety of employees. The second public policy was to replace a system whereby an employee could sue his employer for a safety violation with one in which he now had to file a separate application, the basis of which was Article 2, Section 35. There is no statutory in between here. It derives directly from Article 2, Section 35 of the Constitution. And that application, which is a separate application, would be filed with the Industrial Commission. Another person would have the right to pursue that and obtain his contract.
So your theory is that that an employee, we clearly have an employee here, and we have at least one employer, and your contention seems to be that once we know who the employee is, and there's been a claim recognized by the Industrial Commission, that employee can then file a VSSR against another entity that is an employer, even though that entity is not his employer. Is that because the Constitution gives him the right to, it seemed to give him the right to have the benefit of all of the workers' comp benefits?
Well, Your Honor, I think the starting point with respect to that is the Carr case, which is the 1935 case. And in the Carr case, Basically what they said was that an application is a new, separate, and distinct award. It derives not under the workers' comp law per se, but directly from Article 2, Section 35.
Well, but we have this, we're so bound with all of our thinking that there is one employer for each employee in the state. Isn't that our problem, that we're being asked to break away from that mold in which, because the whole system is based on who is the employee and who is the employer, against whom is this claim going to be, the experience going to be debited.
I don't see any logical problem with that either, Your Honor. I agree with a holding in Daniels versus McGregor. I think that Daniels versus McGregor is a correctly held case. And basically what it said was that you have to look at who has control of this employee. If the customer has control of the method and manner of his work, then the customer is his employer for purposes of that.
So the commission was incorrect when it said that the agency was these persons' employers, right?
Well, I think you have to go back to how that determination was made. And it's really very simple how that determination was made. And the beginning for that is to look to the relationship between the temporary agency and the customer. Before any injury ever takes place, the temporary agency and the customer contract with each other. And the gist of that contract is, and in fact in this context, the entirety of the contract is, that the temporary agency hires or loans the person out to the customer with the idea that the temporary agency will be the employer in case he gets injured. And they agree with the customer and contract with the customer for a fee to cover all of those workers' comp payments, to process the workers' comp claims, to fight it for that matter if they want. And the customer has their, or the temporary agency has their own interests with respect to that. And so if the application is filed, as in, for example, in the Hilliard-Foster case, Hilliard-Foster is a perfect example. He gets injured on the premises of the customer. When he gets injured, he goes to the temporary agency, and the temporary agency then fills out his application and processes it under their risk number, and they certify the claim as being a proper claim. And that's because the customer expects them to do that, because that's what they contracted.
You're saying it's a service provided by the agency, and it's not something from which we conclude who the employer is. That's
exactly right. However, when the claim comes into the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, which the claim is filed with, not the Industrial Commission, when the claim comes into the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, of course, adjudicates the claim. If it's a properly certified claim to the customer's risk number, or the employer's, the temporary employer's risk number, then in fact the claim gets processed under their risk number.
Counsel, the main objection that I hear is that you should have joined all these claims into one action and gone ahead with it. Do you give notice to the party that the BSSR claim was against, and they're handicapped because they missed a lot of these hearings or a lot of this evidence, and now they're at a handicap? Isn't that what you're claiming? You should have done this all at once?
Well,
can you do that?
To begin with, it's impractical to do that from a practical standpoint. The reason being, for example, again, let's look at Hilliard-Foster. Hilliard-Foster filed his own claim. He was injured. He filed his own claim. He didn't file his claim with the benefit of an attorney. And he was told at the time that he was hired through the temporary agency, you're my employer. If you get injured on the job, then you file a claim through us and we'll process it.
In fact,
and
did he know there was a violation at that time?
Of course not. What does he know about the safety regulations?
Well, isn't the problem here, maybe, see if I'm, isn't the problem here that the agencies, the employment agencies are going to their customers and saying, we'll take care of all this for you. We'll be the employer for purposes of workers' comp. And the customer then contracts with them and pays, I assume the contract includes, whether express or not, there's a fee for that. And so if we now say that the employer can, the customer is actually the employer, that seems that's going to upset, not that that's controlling, but that's going to upset these arrangements, I would assume, is it not?
Well, Your Honor, what you're saying then is that you're going to allow two private employers in this state to determine whether a person gets BSSR protection or not.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm still inquiring. I haven't made my decision yet. I just want to see what the impact is. Sometimes we don't recognize what the impact is. I'm just curious as to whether, is that your understanding? Maybe you don't know. It seems to me that's maybe what happens is the agency, which doesn't really control the work of the employee on the site, says as a part of their sales pitch or their reason for business is, we'll take care of all that for you. And that's very attractive to an employer, to a company, to not have to worry about that. So if you don't have an experience and so forth, then you're paying an agency to do that. And what, it seems to me, what we're sort of cutting away this facade or whatever it is, and looking at it from the standpoint of who is really the employer. Your point seems to me to be is that the employer, that arrangement does not determine who is the real employer for purposes of the workers' comp.
Exactly. And furthermore, let me say that there's some financial interest on the part of the customer to do it that way.
Sure.
I mean, they're doing it because it's cheaper. Aside from that, I mean, to suggest that there is no privity of interest between a customer and the employment agency on the underlying claim is ridiculous. The employment agency, they get a per hour fee from the customer, no matter how much the claim is paid out.
So,
in this particular case, the temporary employment agencies are self-insured, so therefore they have a definite interest in holding down the cost on the underlying claim because they're going to have to pay those benefits out of their pocket. It affects their bottom line.
So what you would argue, I guess, what you would be comfortable with is if we were to say that for purposes of paying workers' comp claims and administering the program, the agency can be considered to be the quote employer, but for purposes of the other legal relationships, you have to look beyond that, and you have to look to see who really, you have to apply the traditional test, who controlled the work and so forth, and if you do that, then the customer becomes the employer for purposes of the SSR.
Exactly right, and that's entirely consistent with Daniels versus McGregor and the Reed, the Zito, and the Lyman case that say that you have to look to the issue of who has control. And for that matter, it's completely consistent with the Whitman case and the Morrissey case.
Counselor, let's straighten out the procedure. Maybe that's where the problem is, or maybe I'm confused about the procedure. The claim for the underlying workers' comp was filed simply against the temporary agency.
That's correct.
Then, when you filed, or somebody filed the BSSR, and I have it in front of me, the additional award, it named both the employers. It named both of the entities,
That's
the temporary
correct.
Agency and the customer.
That's correct.
And then, when that happened, the Industrial Commission denied it vis-a-vis the temporary agency and didn't rule on whether the underlying employer, if you will, was responsible.
Well, more than that, they refused to take jurisdiction.
I understand. So they didn't even rule on that issue, even though they were both in the application.
Exactly.
So then you go seek a writ to make sure that the Industrial Commission considers whether or not the underlying employer, if you will, is the employer. And the Court of Appeals said yes, and they brought it here saying, oh, that's not proper. I mean, it sounded to me like your conversation, the way it's been developing, is that you didn't name both entities, and you did.
Oh, I did. Understand, in terms of processing the BSSR claim itself, notice was given in this case to both the customer and the employer.
But that doesn't respond to the state's argument that the customer, who is now going to be penalized, theoretically, for violation of specific safety regulation, wasn't in the original hearing to determine who is the employer. That's their complaint. It's not that they weren't included in the BSSR. Of course they were, but they weren't in the original complaint. That's what they want. Is there any problem with that from your standpoint?
Well, yes, I do.
You'd like to have them there, wouldn't you?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. I have a problem.
They'd wind up being the employer, wouldn't they?
Well, number one, there was never any hearing to determine whether they were injured at all. The claim was certified by the temporary agency. It was processed by the temporary agency.
That's...
And again, they have their own interest in holding the cost down. I think what the Attorney General and the Industrial Commission's concern here is that they didn't have the opportunity, this is the customer, did not have the opportunity or the right to harass this employee with respect to his claim and the payment of his benefits on his claim on the underlying claim in order to reduce their liability personally.
Well, but if we're going to fill a gap for you here that the General Assembly has left, don't we at least have to give, I mean, that may be true here, but we're writing law for other cases. Don't we at least have to give the person who is later going to be accused of having violated a specific safety regulation the ability to come in at where the initial determination is made as to who the employer is, give them a say at the table they aren't all going to be filed by, I would guess, by the, I mean, I would think that sometimes the agency is going to question the scope of employment or whatever, aren't they?
Well,
you don't know,
when a person who is ignorant of the system, which is Hilliard, Foster, and the other people here, get injured on the job, and they go to their employer, who is the temporary agency, because the temporary agency tells someone, here, you get injured on the job, you come to us and file the application with us. They have no clue of the fact that they may have been injured as a result of a safety violation regulation. The customer, pursuant to the contract, and understand, this is pursuant to the contract that the customer and the temporary agency have made. The temporary agency does what the contract requires, which is they accept the claim under their risk number, they pay the benefits of the claim. And so therefore, they're getting, the customer and the temporary agency are getting exactly what they contracted.
You're saying that every claim that's given to a temporary agency is automatically filed by the temporary agency without ever questioning whether the scope of employment, or the, I'm surprised that they would do that. I mean, I think they would probably give the benefit of the doubt, but boy, I'd be surprised if they've got an experience too that they have to look at.
That's exactly right. The temporary agency has an experience, and what I'm saying is that in that regard, they protect the customer with respect to the amount of benefits that are paid on the underlying claim, and especially when the temporary agency is a very, very large employer like Manpower and is self-insured and knows that the more that they can reduce the amount of payment on the underlying claim, the more profit they're going to make. So to suggest that a temporary agency is not going to indirectly protect the interests of the customer with respect to the underlying claim is ridiculous, because they have their own interests, which is the same as the customer's interest. Their bottom line in profit is based on holding their costs paid. And for that matter, a large employer like Manpower, who's in the business of processing these claims, is probably in a better position to hold those costs down than some small employer that hires them out as a temp.
Manpower's employee comes to Manpower and says, I've got a claim for workers' comp. I fell in the shower this before I went to work, and I broke my leg. Had I not been going to work, I wouldn't have gotten up and taken the shower. Then that's the employer's fault. The agency is going to just pass that through to the workers, to the bureau, and say, pay it?
Absolutely not. Because
that's my point.
That's my point.
There are issues that the agency may have with respect to whether they want to pay the claim that suggests that they aren't going to just pass off every claim to the bureau and say, pay it. And that's why it seems to me if we're going to do this, there has to be some notice given to the supposed employer, the real employer.
Well, what does a temporary agency do when they are faced with an injury of one of their employees who's working under the control of the customer? They have to process the application. So the first thing they're going to do is they're going to call up this customer and they're going to say, tell me how this happened. Did this really happen the way he claims it happened? Quite clearly, you're crossing. And they're going to investigate it, see whether it's a proper claim, and if it's a proper claim, they're going to pay it. If it's not a proper claim, then they're going to fight it.
Sure.
I mean, because and they, of course, have a direct interest in fighting it because it affects their bottom line, too. So therefore, to suggest that the customer is somehow totally out of the loop in this is ridiculous. They're in it from the beginning.
Thank you, Mr. Kaufman.
Thank you.
Ms. Nestor, you've used your time, but take 30 seconds, if you like.
Thank you, Mayor. One point I would like to make would be in response to Judge's question about what the Industrial Commission did in this case. The decision in this case did, in fact, rule that the employers were temporary agencies in this case. In the Newman case, the decision holds that the employer, in that particular case, is the authority of the agency. In the Foster case, they held that it was uncontested that the employer in that claim was good for temporary services. And in the Henderson case, they held that Kelly services was the employer against whom the claim is allowed, and that Forest City strengthened the claim and the Industrial Commission is without jurisdiction to enter in order affecting the legal rights and duties of such a third party. Clearly, from the face of those decisions, the Industrial Commission considered this a matter of res judicata, had the claimants wish to contest whether the employers or the agencies or the
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.